It's difficult to examine the brutal history of the federal government forcibly removing children from their homes, not because they were in need of help, because they were indigenous. The people who occupied North America before there was a United States were subjected to prisoner treatment and forced family separation, sending Native children to boarding schools starting in the 1800s. The governmental mindset was to assimilate Native children to live like white Americans. The work to clarify the full story of the boarding school era and the road to healing is our discussion today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The damage from ripping away language, culture, and family cohesion continues to affect Native communities today. And as a parent and grandparent, thinking about the horror of strangers showing up on your doorstep, seizing your kids, and taking off with them to some unknown place is a pain I can't imagine. It's hard to think about living through that total loss of parental authority, protection, and control over your own small family members. Reading part of an elder's memory about how quiet the community was after the children were taken away was difficult, but also important for gaining understanding of the enormous and traumatic effect this era of forced assimilation and separation had on Native people across Alaska and the Lower 48. The federal government has released two volumes on its role in the formation and operation of boarding schools. The second volume was released last month and contains personal stories of survivors of the schools and lists about 1,000 known deaths of children at the schools. Here to help us understand the significance of these reports and the work that remains to be done is Jim LaBelle. Jim is on the line from Dillingham and is a boarding school survivor and a board member of the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition. Jim, thanks for being on with us today.
My pleasure.
In the studio with me today is Benjamin Jasek. Benjamin is the Director of Indigenous Research with the Alaska Native Heritage Center. Hi, Benjamin. Thanks for being here.
Yagakidu. Glad to be here.
Great. And later in the program, we'll be joined by Amber Ebarb. Amber is the Minority Staff Director for the Senate Indian Affairs Committee Vice Chairman, who is Senator Lisa Murkowski. When Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced the release of the second volume of the report on Indian boarding schools, she said the very cabinet that was created to assimilate Indigenous people produced the report, detailing the trauma and damage caused by this system from 1819 through the 1970s. She thanked people for sharing their stories and said they are the foundation of the work.
As we continue to build out a permanent oral history collection, please know that we will care for these stories as if they were our own. The Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative has been one of the most important and meaningful things I have done as secretary. It shows us that representation truly matters. Using my platform to give voice to our people, our struggles, and our contributions to this nation as its original stewards has been the honor of my lifetime. Thank you for entrusting us to help tell our story, because Native American history is American history. Dawa'e.
Such a true statement. That is our history, and it's important to look at it all in its fullness. Jim, start us off here. You were only 8 years old when you were sent to the Wrangell Institute. You said in a recent KMBA story that the stories collected in Volume 2 are shocking and hard, and the work yet to come is going to be difficult. Tell us about what you recorded for this report.
Well, as you mentioned, it was a pretty painful experience to reconnect with those memories of our experiences at Wrangell Institute, or at least mine. And I still find it pretty difficult to express all the things that need to be said. I went to Wrangell in 1955, which was a whole lifetime or two ago, and the treatment, the separation from family, the struggle to try to maintain who we were was slowly erased. And in my case, I think I was just totally, at the end of 10 years of boarding school, I really didn't know who I was as a Native person. I was bilingual, and at the end of 10 years, I could no longer speak Inupiaq. I didn't know my own culture, my own way of living. And there was a great shame, and I was lost. And even at 77 years old, I'm still trying to capture some of those wonderful indigenous traditional ways that I should have learned growing up.
What a tremendous amount of loss. And I so admire that you do the work knowing that you carry such a tough and painful history. Jim, talk a little bit about what the two volumes that have now been released contained and what you see as needed for next steps.
Well, I think the first volume, just attempted to identify just all of the institutions that were scattered across the country, including Alaska, and trying to get a sense of the scale of what was happening, dealing with them, but the work that they had contracted to the various churches as well. I think the second volume that just came out is starting to tease out some of the impacts of that assimilation and acculturation work that was being done the last 150 years. And I still believe there's a lot more that needs to be done.
And along those lines, Jim, you're a board member, as we noted earlier, of the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition. The coalition has its own maps of boarding schools in the United States, but it differs from the maps that the Department of Interior released. What are the differences, and are they being reconciled with the federal government's report?
I think in part it has a lot to do with whether there were direct connections between the federal government and other churches with respect to boarding schools, because some of these schools are operated totally independent of the government. But as we know, there were a lot more boarding schools than were enumerated by those reports or those findings. And on our website, we do have an interactive map that people could go to click on a particular school. And a lot of the information about that place does come up. But I think it's going to require maybe some sort of negotiated process. We need to get our federal government to acknowledge those other institutions.
All right. Thank you for getting us started, Jim. Ben, I want to turn to you now as you are, again, a reminder to our audience, we're talking about the boarding school, the legacy of boarding schools and their continued effect on Native communities across Alaska and the lower 48. There are two volumes now of reports that the federal government, the Department of Interior, has released. And we've been talking with Jim LaBelle, who is a boarding school survivor and board member of the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition. He's on the line with us from Dillingham, and we'll find out more about why he's in Dillingham in just a bit. In the studio with me is Benjamin Jasek. Benjamin is the Director of Indigenous Research with the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and we're going to hear from Amber Ebarb, who is the Minority Staff Director for Senate Indian Affairs Committee Vice Chair Senator Lisa Murkowski in just a bit. Ben, you also have different findings in your research from what the federal government has as far as documenting facilities that were schools. Tell us about these disparities between your research and the Department of Interior's findings. And are you also trying to figure out to get the federal government to acknowledge these?
Yeah, thank you very much. So over at the Alaska Native Heritage Center, we've been really focusing on a selection of primary source material that the federal government hasn't been able to look over yet, because the reports really, it was focusing upon the federal material available at places like NARA or Kansas City, without being able to really look at how, without really being able to look at how the involvement of the churches looked like. And since Alaska, especially early in its inception of the boarding school, assimilated boarding school project, was mainly church or ecclesially run. And by church, I mean all the different denominations. Really, there are always going to be a couple of gaps. And that's something that the reports really acknowledge, that you know, it's not the end-all, say-all, but there's really the first, it's really the first and second step of many steps to come.
And you've said Alaska in the past got left out of the boarding school discussion. Why?
In terms of just because Alaska usually the conversation is centered around things like Carlisle. And because really in Alaska, there hasn't been as much research done from the get-go. It seems as if even for us, whenever we began our research, whenever I started about 10 years ago, it almost felt like we were stumbling in the dark because we really didn't know very much. But in looking through a lot of these documents and actually understanding this history more fully from looking at all these primary source materials, Alaska is really becoming much more part of the larger conversation and having a much more central role, especially now that, unlike a lot of other places, you know, we do have access to a lot of these ecclesial primary source material, especially things like Sheldon Jackson, the head of education in Alaska, and really the creator of the Boarding School Project here in Alaska. Having access to a lot of his records that really haven't seen the light of day in what would be over 100 years.
As you've been researching this history, as you mentioned, for the past 10 years, what have you learned about how Alaska boarding schools compare to the lower 48 boarding school system? Were they better here? Were they worse? Were they about the same as the lower 48? Or is there not enough known yet?
Well, when we talk about comparatively, you know, what was better or what was worse, if we don't start the conversation off with taking children away from their parents,
forcibly, it's always bad.
Yeah, to forcibly assimilate them, then we're starting off on the wrong spot. Especially at ANHC, Alaska Native Heritage Center, we've been looking at it from a more structural perspective, because many people had many different experiences, but what was the intended consequences and how have they played out today? And how do we see the effects of the boarding schools affecting Alaska Native, American Indian, Native Hawaiian peoples today is really a big point that we all need to really center our minds around when talking about this issue. In terms of Alaska, one thing that makes it a bit more, as opposed to experiences, looking more at the structure, what makes it really important is seeing really the how all of these denominations ultimately work together in a way that had never been seen before in history through something called the Comity Plan. It's spelled C-O-M-I-T-Y.
Yes.
or comedy agreement, something that we've been able to do a lot of primary source material research on, where it was the first time, it was where in 1880, a lot of these Protestant, major Protestant denominations got together in New York in, I believe, January 19th, and pulled out a map of Alaska and circled the part of Alaska they wanted to take control of.
I've heard of this through the years many times, that the churches came into Alaska and just sort of carved up the state and said, okay, this is your region, that's your region, but didn't know of, I've heard the stories, but had not heard of the actual documentation that you've been able to find now.
Yeah, so it's really been a thing that has been very based upon like secondary source material or little bits and pieces of primary source material. And up until about 2 years ago, like we didn't even really know the year they occurred. There's even a peer-reviewed academic article, white paper, that believes it to be kind of something a bit more mythological. But about 2 years ago, not only did we find letters of all these denominations talking about what occurred in the meeting, but even a map of which is right now in the process of being published in academic, peer-reviewed academic journal, which should come out in the next couple months. But what it really shows is when the Protestants got together and split up Alaska, really mainly for economic reasons, that was really the first time that you see all these Protestant denominations in the Western Church get together and agree upon something. Then in 1883, you have the inclusion of the Roman Catholic Church, which means it's the first time that at least I know of in history where all of the Western Church got together and could agree upon one thing, and that one thing was the assimilation, forced assimilation of Alaska Native children for economic benefit.
And as we know, there is no way that you can make people be someone they are not. You can't take people from one culture and turn them into little people of another culture. That doesn't work, and we continue to see the fallout today. Jim, I want to go back to you. The federal government toured the nation last year collecting stories from Indigenous people who were survivors and family members of survivors. What did you hear from people who took part in this process? How has that been for them?
I seem to see a pattern of that came out in their stories that and that it, for lack of a better word or term, is just a sheer trauma of separating children from their families and from their communities and reservations. The shared history of physical abuse, emotional abuse, psychological abuse, sexual abuse, and spiritual abuse. That seems to be consistent all the way across many of these stories, although I do know that when they were actually told, they were told in quite confidence with the, between the storyteller and the recorder. I only know that because I told my own story when they were at the Alaska Native Heritage Center a year ago or so, when they came up here. And I was one of the respondents that told my stories.
Are you concerned that this might be it, that the two volumes the federal government released could be all that happens, or are there signs that you see that this work will continue and that there will be more?
Ben, do you want to try that first, or you would like me to crack at it? Have a crack at it.
Either way, if you want me to go first and then you add on, then
okay,
you can, yeah,
please.
So really, when we look at the Boring School Initiative Volume 1 and 2, it's really highlighting, like it's been said before, the federal, really what the federal government knows of what they did, starting that research in that. What we see Volume 1 and 2 doing, especially at this point, is uplifting the Boarding School Truth and Healing Commission bill, which Amber will be able to talk much more in depth about. But what we see Volume 1 and 2 being is, like we said before, the first and second steps of really bringing this history to light. And because whenever we do talk about this history, whenever we bring it to light and re-understand our own identities as Native peoples, that's really where we find healing. Because you don't know what you need healing from until you actually take off the Band-Aid. Jim, is there anything you would like to add?
Yes, Jim, please.
What I've noticed about these two documents is that they've purposefully have kept their hands away and off of their involvement that they had with the various church denominations that Ben was talking about. And to me, this is where the third and fourth and other volumes need to become part of the story. That wasn't really addressed, in my opinion. There's a pretty significant involvement by these different groups that helped the federal government with their assimilation processes, but yet they seem to be really not as listed or upfront or even a hint that this is where they could go.
And Ben, you mentioned the differences previously of the various reports, the Department of Interior's two volumes, the BIA office report, the report of the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition. What did these various reports and documents reveal collectively about the extent of boarding schools and what is still missing?
Yeah, thank you very much. I want to highlight exactly what Jim said very masterfully, is that really the one thing in terms of what is missing from specifically this report is really the ecclesial involvement, and not only just the involvement, but the partnership that we see. One thing that you see across the board is really a framework being developed with this kind of relationship between all the reports, all the things that, you know, the Senate has come out with, NABS, the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, have come up with, what ANHC has come up with, in the documentation is really showing that these were not all just isolated points, but through this partnership of both federal and ecclesial, you see really a system take place, a system that really was never, at the end of the day, systemically, really for the benefit of Alaska Native, American Indian, Native Hawaiian children, but really a way or kind of a alternative to like what you see in the Lower 48 with the Indian Wars, as it's called. In Alaska, really you see that alternative become the main method of colonization, even though for the first 10 years of the United States ownership of Alaska or the territory, it being controlled by the Department of War, which is a whole nother story. But really we see not only that, but also that system spreading not only throughout all of the U.S., but also to places like Canada. When you look at their Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you really see them pointing their fingers back to the U.S. saying they need to figure out where it really originated because we got this from them. Same with places like Australia, New Zealand, connections with various parts of Africa even, in terms of when the different states went over and split up, like, for instance, Western Africa. You see a lot of the same frameworks from places so like the Comedy Plan.
The same tools of oppression traveled around the world.
100%. I mean, when you look at even the connection between the U.S. and Alaska, Carlisle, and Jackson, you see that they had a very strong relationship with one another. You start to see the same actors pop up time and time again, really for the exact same reasons that I've stayed before and Jim has stayed before.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the boarding school era, the pain that still exists in Native communities today because of the ripple effect of that trauma from more than 150 years of boarding school era for both Alaska Native people and Indigenous people in the Lower 48. Jim LaBelle is on the line from Dillingham with us, and Ben Jasek is in the studio with us. We're going to hear from Amber Ebarb in just a bit after a break. But before we go to a break, let's hear from Burl, who is in Haines. Hello, Burl.
Hello, Lori. Haines was the site of the Haines House, which was run by the Presbyterian Mission, the National Mission, between 1921 and 1959. I'm curious what the presenters would suggest as to how our community can access the Sheldon Jackson archives and be more involved in unpacking this tragic piece of history.
Thanks, Burl. Ben?
Hey, thank you very much, Burl. This is Ben Jasek. If you can, you can actually email me. We've actually been working with the Haines community on primary source material research and even potentially talking about, you know, what's next steps after understanding this kind of truth. Especially with the Presbyterian Church. But yeah, if you want, you can go ahead and email me.
Yeah, we'll connect. Yeah. We'll have your phone number and we'll be able to connect you, Burl, with Ben after Talk of Alaska today.
Yeah. And the other thing is that we are working to digitize the items that really we found that have been inside of a basement, you know, a closet door for the last 100 or so years, for everyone to be able to have access to all these
items.
Those will
be online at some point.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Jim LaBelle, boarding school survivor and board member of the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition, Ben Jasek, the Director of Indigenous Research with Alaska Native Heritage Center. And when we return from our break, we'll hear from Amber Ebarb, who is the Minority Staff Director for the Senate Indian Affairs Committee Vice Chair, Senator Lisa Murkowski, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the new reports that have been released by the federal government, two volumes of reports on the 150 years of the boarding school era for Indigenous people in both the Lower 48 and Alaska. Let's bring on Amber Ebarb now. Amber has been patiently waiting. Thank you so much, Amber. And Amber is the Minority Staff Director for the Senate Indian Affairs Committee Vice Chair, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Amber, thanks for being on with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the Truth and Healing Commission concept, how that came together and what it will aim to do.
Yeah, happy to. First, though, I want to thank Jim LaBelle and Ben Jasek and so many others who have helped shine a light on this time period and the impact of these policies on Native communities. They have been really important voices as we've worked on this topic and worked on this legislation in the Senate and with our House counterparts. As you mentioned, Senator Murkowski is the lead Republican in the Senate on legislation that would create a Truth and Healing Commission on Indian boarding schools. That's S-1723. This bill would be complementary to the work that Secretary Holland has done at the Department of Interior on the two reports that you were just discussing with Jim and Ben. We see it as complimentary, and the DOI official who led the report, Brian Newland himself, said it's his hope that this report does not mark the end of the U.S. government's work. It should be the beginning of a long overdue effort to heal. And as you may know, Congress is not, we haven't fully acknowledged past policies that sought to assimilate Native peoples in the United States. So our legislation, led by Senator Warren and Senator Murkowski as the lead Republican, it would establish a Native-led process to examine and heal from such policies.
And Amber, along those lines, I often hear Alaska Native people here say, nothing about us without us. So were Alaska Native people involved in how this commission was put together?
Yeah, the bill had extensive input from stakeholders, tribal leaders, faith-based leaders as well. Church groups have issued letters of support, and it's totally true. Nothing without us, nothing about us without us is a good mantra. And since the 1970s, we've been in an era of self-determination and self-governance. It's a policy that really works. You see it in the transformation of the delivery of healthcare, tribal healthcare, and governmental services in Alaska. We're very proud of the way that when you involve Native voices and Native leadership, it improves delivery of services. And when you have firsthand experiences, it leads to better outcomes. But as you mentioned earlier, the gut-wrenching history where at some points in this policy era of assimilation, all of the children being taken from a village to an Indian boarding school and then leaving in the village, just adults remaining. It's just hard to imagine the sadness and the impact, the unspoken trauma that sort of ripples in our communities to today. At the same time, you know, research shows that culture and connectedness is an important protective factor against trauma. It helps build resilience against addiction, and culture heals. But, you know, federal government, they are the ones who implemented these policies that separated children from their families and their communities. Congress first started appropriating money to this campaign in 1819. That's when Congress passed the Indian Civilization Fund Act and set up this type of education and Indian boarding school system. So it's, Senator Murkowski has said, it's incumbent on the federal government to reckon with the legacy of that dark time period. So this legislation, we had a very robust markup. We had a series of hearings, both on the report and the legislation. We had testimony from Alaskans. Hundreds of people wrote in and informed the development of the legislation as it was reported to the floor of the Senate earlier this year.
The commission would have some subpoena power. What will this help with? Who might be subpoenaed?
Yeah, we debated extensively the role and the type of subpoena authority that this commission should have and be able to exercise. There are a number of commissions that Congress has created over the years. We looked at the types of subpoena authority that those commissions were able to have to obtain information on to implement their charges. Our subpoena authority has quite narrow. It's quite narrow compared to the other commissions. But we heard from witnesses and from testimony and letters, comments that the ability to obtain information is essential to the effectiveness and just the severity of what occurred in the United States over the years. But we also see it as a tool of last resort. I think Ben mentioned there are lots of church leaders and ecclesial institutions that are already interested in voluntarily sharing information with tribes and with researchers to better understand this time period. Because I think we are all interested, many faith-based organizations and church leaders are already interested in pursuing healing and reconciliation. So we've been encouraged to hear about the positive letters from some of the churches, but some churches have said that for some records to be shared, a subpoena would be helpful to turn over those types of documents. So we have kept it in, although it has been scaled down quite a bit compared to other congressionally created commissions.
And where is the legislation for this commission currently? I understand you're working to get unanimous consent on the Senate floor for this legislation. Why is that desired rather than a straight up vote? What's happening there?
Yeah, we reported the we had our markup on this legislation last summer. We worked on a very comprehensive committee report that detailed our work on the need, the purpose, the background, the legislative history, the comparisons to other truth and reconciliation and healing efforts in North America as sort of models and ways that, you know, we were building our commission based on those. So we issued our committee report earlier this year, sending it to the floor of the Senate. And the Senate, there's a process where you can hotline a bill to get unanimous consent to pass it. So we're working towards that. That's how most tribal and Indian Affairs legislation gets passed. But there's all sorts of ways forward on how we might pass it through the Senate. We're also working with our House colleagues. They have reported it out of the House Education and Workforce Committee. So we're all hands on deck and trying to move it forward.
Will the commission, if the legislation is successful and makes it through the House and Senate, will the commission be focused primarily on discovery of church records as it relates to schools, or what will this focus be?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the ways, especially that is complementing the Department of Interior boarding school initiative, there they focused on Department of Interior records. The Indian Boarding Schools Policies Act would be able to focus their scope of an investigation on federal and non-federal records. They would work with some of the faith-based organizations. The oversight would be from the Department of Justice and Congress. It would have a 5-member commission. It would have a number of a subcommittee, a survivor subcommittee, and a Native American advisory committee to help shape the scope of their investigation. It would also look at repatriation and reburial support and make recommendations for ways for Native people to find healing in the future.
And are you hearing from churches now? Are they responding to this idea of a commission and what may be coming? And if so, what are you hearing?
Yeah, we have some support from faith-based organizations and some of the churches. We've been in communication with some of the churches who have already issued apologies in Alaska and in the lower 48 to Native communities and Native peoples. We have a joint statement endorsing the legislation from 7 religious groups, which is really helpful. And then we have more informal sort of discussions with faith-based leaders on ways forward. As you may know, some of them have their own processes in place to pursue healing. And there's encouragement from some denominations for voluntary collaboration and sharing information. So we're heartened to see those relationships unfold.
All right. Well, Amber, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. We need to take a short break, but we just heard from Amber Ebarb, who is the Minority Staff Director for Senate Indian Affairs Committee Vice Chair, Senator Lisa Murkowski. Amber, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
We will return with our discussion about the history and reporting on the Native boarding school era as Talk of Alaska continues statewide after this break. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the era of the boarding schools and the trauma that still exists in Native communities today has rippled out for generations from that era, and what needs to happen to help people heal and be able to move forward in a good way. We are going to go to the phones in just a moment here, but I wanted to read an email from Helen, who wrote from Juneau. I was in Juneau Public Schools, K through 6, subjected to the same treatment that Jim LaBelle shares. I just lived at home. She writes, when I would tell an adult what was happening at school, they would say, it's better than being sent to boarding school. My teachers would hit me with a 4-foot bamboo mat pointer with no explanation as to why. I started out left-handed. I was hit with a ruler with a metal edge with teacher yelling, wrong hand. And at least then I knew why I was being hit. She says, after being hit twice in one day, I would spend the rest of the day in a broom closet with no window, chair, or doorknob to open it from the inside. I was forced to go to a speech therapist to train the native voice out of me. Also, a lot of my friends in Anchorage were here in the boarding home program where they were placed in foster homes in Anchorage and Fairbanks. They were isolated and alone. Sorry for your experience, Helen. Thank you for the note. Jim, children were forced to work in agriculture and a lot of other settings. You worked on a farm. Tell us about that experience, and were you ever at all compensated for that work?
I don't recall ever being compensated. I do remember arriving home from Mount Edgecombe and was met by this strange family who said that I was going to be their foster kids for the summer, and they happen to work at Creamer's Dairy in Fairbanks, which is now a bird sanctuary. But back when I was there in the 60s, it was a working dairy farm. I did a lot of the stuff, you know, farm kids did. I just never had done it before, and I got my meals and a bed, but I never was compensated, to my knowledge. I was a teenager. I was 16, 17 years old.
Ben, your research also uncovered stories of children working in fisheries, in mining and agriculture, as Jim experienced. Tell us about what you found in that regard.
Yeah, thank you. Much to echo what Jim was talking about, manual labor was a really big aspect of a lot of these institutions that span all across the state, all across the U.S. There's several reasons for this in their own minds, because Alaska was split up mainly for economic pursuits. For them, they saw a reason to then put all the kids they're trying to assimilate to work for their own benefit. A lot of the way that it's been talked about, especially recently, is especially connected to like the issue of the Pribilof Islands up until the 1970s. You see a lot of instances of things that have been attributed to be like slavery to some extent, unpaid labor, indentured servanthood are a lot of the languages you see, especially in like contracts. And another thing would be a lot of the rationale for a lot of these teachers and institutions would be you now have to pay your own way to stay at a place you never wanted to stay at from the get-go. And now you have to work. There have been instances in Alaska as well as I believe in the lower 48 I've seen where a lot of the times in the entry form, it would list out what does your family own? Really as a way to be able to take away, from Native communities, Native families as a result of this debt that was forced upon people.
Let's go to the phones a moment. Ethel is in Soldotna. Hi, Ethel.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we're having a very important discussion today, but one that's not easy to have. How are you?
Exactly. I want to start out with by thanking Jim LaBelle for being so persistent and so conscientious about never letting our leaders and the people back east forget about this long-standing wound. My questions relate to two things. Number one, has anyone recorded how important it is for our people in order to heal and deal with the long-term damage according to their own standards, how important it is for them to be to have the responsibility of designing and implementing their own methods and practices of healing, and how thoroughly that healing process is occurring. And number two, in any long-term reports or studies that result from this, how important it is to be aware of how thoroughly our governance systems and our practices and some of our tribal court systems have been modeled on a Western society's ideas of the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary, and how our people, I think we're losing track of how important it is to resolve all of these kinds of matters according to our own customs and our own standards before we lose too many generations. Is anybody making sure that whatever commission is established, that it is made aware of, and is its final report focus on these kinds of approaches?
Thank you, Ethel, for your ideas and suggestions. Jim, I want to turn to you first. Is there funding? I didn't get that question out to Amber, but are you aware of funding that's available from the federal government? Is there money that comes with this documentation to help not only with the commission making outreach, but also your organization, the Coalition on Healing? Is there funding available to help find records and to also help aid in culturally appropriate healing?
Yeah, those are very good questions. And first up, I'd like to thank you for your kind words. For the listeners overall, there is a provision in the Truth and Healing Commission bill to have establishment of healing centers across America. And the funding part is kind of not been really identified, although there's suggestions that we try to find monies that would normally have gone to other federal programs that could be taken for this purpose. I don't think that's yet to be totally ironed out. But Ethel, you're also right about how we've more or less have learned how to emulate the Western concepts of leadership and governance. And I do know that there are different groups across the country that are starting to indigenize the way that they resolve their problems and issues. And that's happening up here as well. It's just happening in little conclaves. And at some point, hopefully, we can have a gathering of sorts at this, where these folks can share how they're doing it.
All right. Well, thank you for that little. I want to get one more caller in our final few minutes here. Matthew is on the line from Anchorage. Ethel, thank you for your call. Now let's go to Matthew. Hello, Matthew.
Good morning. We appreciate hearing the discussions over the air. I'm a product of Chemawa Indian High School, and the experiences talked about, Jim, publicly, and also, working with Senator Murkowski, is very much appreciated. And I hope the commission, there should be some hearings through the creation of this commission, that the hearing from a lot of the participants that are aging. I'm 71 now. I look at the years of the high school that I went to, the missed opportunities that I saw in relationship building as a teenager that I missed out between the parents. That's, very important in relationship building. The other areas where some parts of, how the Bureau ran the system for, oppressive type of authorities that were presented on campuses, on how students are treated on campus. those aging populations now should be able to have that opportunity to testify in front of the commission and talk about the missed opportunities. As an example, when I was, when a group of us in Chimaua wanted to present, an application because we were turning of age for Native allotments, the authority there, the superintendent there during that time said, you're living down here, you're not in Alaska, you have no opportunity to apply. There are about 8-9 of us that, went together, and we want to present our app, the opportunity to apply for Native allotments. And I wouldn't be the, we wouldn't be the only ones. There are other students that were not able to present, these missed opportunities. And I hope the commission will be funded through the Indian Affairs, and I thank the Jim LaBelle for, presenting this issue for some time. And the healing process takes time. And, there you'll hear more of opportunities for people that can present their testimonies, their views through the commission hearings that, should be forwarded. And I appreciate that you're putting this on the air. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew, for your call. Such an important point that Matthew raised about another loss, that people in schools outside of the state weren't allowed to apply for land, didn't get Native allotments. So much to do. We only have a couple minutes left here. And Jim, I wanted to turn back to you. For people listening that may be carrying this type of pain, either directly from their own experience in a boarding school or grieving for a family member who suffered at one, what do you want them to know about this work and healing and where they should turn to for guidance and help?
Well, that's a good question as well. And I'm hoping that the Alaska Heritage Center, with Ben and Emily and with the NABS folks, we'd like to encourage this DOI group in healing and hearing more testimony in Alaska. They only came to Alaska, to Anchorage, and as we all know, Alaska is such a big state with over 229 villages, and virtually every one of those villages had people that attended boarding school of one kind or another, yet I don't think they really had an opportunity to share their perspective. So I'm hoping we can figure out a way to get them to come back and expand their processes up here.
Yeah. And Ben, in our final minute here, what would you recommend for people? How can they reach out for help?
So there are a couple of ways. Over at ANHC, you can contact us. We're starting to do a bit more oral history in recording. And so if you would like, please reach out to us. Conclude is that, especially for testimony and telling this story, it's not the end, but the beginning. And so we're making sure to have as many chances to tell this story, a story that, my own grandfather wasn't able to tell.
Thank you so much to our guest today, Jim LaBelle, boarding school survivor and board member of the National Native Boarding School Healing Coalition, Benjamin Jasek, the Director of Indigenous Research with the Alaska Native Heritage Center, and we heard from Amber Ebarb, the Minority Staff Director for Senate Indian Affairs, Vice Chair Senator Lisa Murkowski. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Ava White helped us out today. We'll put links on our website with the Talk of Alaska Post. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.